Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's afternoon satsang. As always, we've been joined by Prem and Arvind from Team Radio Sai. At the very outset, Navratri greetings to all of you. We're having a wonderful Dashera celebrations here, and more than that, we also have beautiful rains yet this morning, even as we tune in live to all of and meet all of you. We're going to continue with the Bhagavatam session. This is the fortnight where we speak about Swami's Bhagavatvahini. Before we continue with that, I'll offer on behalf of all of us loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet and invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem, you were speaking about the rain, and I must say that this is something amazing. We might have stated this multiple times on air, but I would like to state it again that I wonder how is it that any festival that comes in Prashanthi Nilayam has some rain coming along with it. I don't think it can be termed a coincidence any longer. In fact, when it comes to God, I think nothing can be termed as a coincidence, but even the most rational of minds, even the most skeptic of minds will be forced to pause and ponder about this, because there are festivals throughout the year. Ugadi, Ramanavami, they come during the summer months. Then there is Guru Purnima, there is Aradhana Mahotsavam, then there is Ganesh Chaturthi, Krishna Janmashtami, Christmas, Swami's birthday, Dasara. It's amazing how Shankranti, how during all the festivals which are spanning across the 12 months of the year, we get rain here. Of course, the intensity of rain varies, but there is some rain fall or the other. And this time, as you said, Dasara has brought a downpour. It's almost like Swami has blessed us in abundance, a lot of rain falling, and this rain falling makes you feel so happy, so wonderful. It's almost like Swami coming and giving darshan, because whenever you have Swami's darshan, irrespective of what kind of mood you're in, what kind of situation you're in your life, when you just see Swami, everything seems to go away and a kind of lightness enters your heart, however dark or heavy it might be feeling. In the same way, however dark or heavy the heart is feeling, when the rains come, they bring some cheer in Prashanti, in Puttaparthi especially, and that's what has happened to all of us today morning. So in that kind of lightheartedness and joy, dear listeners, we will be proceeding along this beautiful story, the story of the Lord, the Bhagavata Vahini, the Bhagavatam. As we learnt last week, it is something that connects the Bhakta with Bhagavan. It is the story of the Lord which connects the devotee with the Lord. And we also recapitulated how Swami had said, Bhagavatamu. Bhagavatamu. In Telugu it means you will become good. Bhagavatam is that listening to which you become good. We become good. We become noble. We go closer to our final destination. We go closer to our ultimate reality. And that is the Bhagavatam that sage Shuka has agreed to expound and tell the stories of to King Parikshit, who considers himself extremely blessed and lucky to be able to hear this in the last few days of his life, because he wishes to lead his last few days of his life in a manner such that he never has to come back for a rebirth once again. And among all the different suggestions offered to him, everyone agrees that sage Shuka's advice, suggestion is true, is the perfect one, which is to hear the stories of Leelas of God with complete faith, surrender and devotion. Not with the mind of a critic, not with the mind of a rationalist or anything like that, but with a heart and mind suffused with love for God. When you listen, you get redeemed. That is the ultimate panacea. We examined that last week as well, where sage Vedavyasa, the foremost intellectual the world has ever known, also found panacea only in the stories of the Lord, which he submitted himself to with all love and devotion. And as Shuka said, it is not just Parikshit who is blessed, because through him, all of us will be blessed to go through the story of the Bhagavatam. Of course, since we are doing it from Radio Sai, the stories of the Bhagavatam will definitely get interspersed with the stories of the Sai Bhagavatam, which are equally sweet, if not more for us, which are equally beautiful, if not more for us, and definitely, like the Bhagavatam, the stories of the Sai Bhagavatam too will lead us to our ultimate destiny.
And as we spoke last week, it comes from a question which is very relevant to all of us, because the way Swami phrases it, as we said, you know, Parikshit asked this question, if one is certain about his death, what should one do to sanctify one's time? And I think that is applicable whether or not Takshaka is coming after us 7 days later. Because as we said, everybody knows that that is the only inevitability of life itself. But interestingly, you know, what Shuka says is you have to spend your time listening to the Bhagavatam. So if that is the case, does that mean that we have to lead our life only listening to the Bhagavatam? We spoke about how to start with, at least, you know, when you're allowed a little bit of free time, is it the stories of the Lord you're gravitating towards? That is the first thing. But probably a more subtler thing than that is something which we, you know, many times notice in our lives, especially when we call ourselves devotees of Swami. You know, when that line between what is Swami's story and what is your story actually starts blurring. When you start leading your life, because that is why the explanation of what is Bhagavatam is so very important, what Shuka Maharishi says now, and what Swami said in the introduction to Bhagavatavani itself, where Swami explained what is Bhagavatam. Is it the story of the Lord? Is it the story of a devotee? Is it the story of devotion? Is it the story of grace? Or is it the story of correcting a person who has gone astray? And Swami says it is all of it. So which means that any event which happens in your life, if we come to a point where we see Swami's hand in it and say that even if something unpleasant happens, something pleasant happens, whether it is gratitude or whether it is surrender, you know, all of that becomes a part of the story of Swami's Bhagavatam playing out in your life. I think that is probably the larger message which Shuka is giving, where you see and listen to, I mean, you literally witness your own life as a part of Swami's Bhagavatam.
As you rightly said, it's not about spending every moment of our life, every day in our life, either narrating or listening to stories of God. Thinking of an analogy, this is what comes in mind. It's a popular analogy, and in different ways Swami has used it and different people have used it. It's like when an actor in a movie or a drama realizes that he's an actor playing a role, then he goes through the ups and downs of the role, the happiness that the role brings in that role. You know, as a player in the drama, there are some happy things that the script might have brought forth for me. Though as a role I celebrate, in my heart neither am I happy nor am I sad, because I know that I am not affected by any of this. This is the role that is getting it. And the same holds true with the tragedy as well. In my role I may lose somebody who is dear to me, I may have a medical problem, the role that I am playing. But when I am playing the role, yes, all those emotions play out on my face. I am acting the role. The difference between being the role and acting the role is the awareness that I am not this role. Therefore, though I am able to shed tears from my eyes, in fact, the way I shed tears, all the onlookers, the audience also have tears in their eyes because they are empathizing with me. Me as my role, not with me, with my role. That, to that perfection I play the role, but I am personally not affected either by sorrow or happiness. And that is the way I feel we have to lead our life also. When we say that we make our life into his Bhagavatam, we realize that we are all playing out roles scripted by God, the divine director. And therefore, any role that I play in the script that he has written is his Bhagavatam only, his story only. And it is this attitude and this realization that we have to spend every moment of our life with. So it is not like I stop going to my workplace, I stop caring for my near and dear ones, or I stop anything. I continue to do everything just with a changed awareness, possibly not changed awareness, just with the awareness of the reality.
And absolutely. In fact, there was a beautiful analogy which Swami gave the last time through Shuka Maharishi's explanation about the sugar cane and the fiber which holds the juice of the sugar cane, where he says that, you know, the essence of the sugar cane, why you are attracted to the sugar cane is the sweet essence, but it doesn't come just as an essence, but it comes encapsulated in this fiber. Or what do you call the bagasse, is it? Is that how
bagasse,
it's pronounced?
Bagasse,
okay, that's how it's pronounced. So Swami says that the other stories or the unpleasant aspects of the story which you'll eventually hear, you know, for instance, if you listen to the story of Lord Krishna, I mean, we know that it is a story of Krishna, so we're always having that feeling of, you know, we know that he's the hero and he's going to win nevertheless. But if you look at it objectively, here is the character of Kamsa who is actually troubling his own sister, his own brother-in-law, his own nephew, that is probably the negative aspect of the story, but Swami says that that all is something which holds this essence together. And that is the nature with which we have to look at our own lives. I mean, even if we look at some things which happen, which happens around us, we like, how can this happen? Swami, how can there be so much evil in the world that you have created? How can there be evil in the organization that you have created, in the ashram that you have created? These are all questions which always come to us. I think that is the answer which Swami gave. It is like that fiber which holds together. If you concentrate too much on the fiber, you actually miss out the essence. The idea of enduring the fiber is to draw the essence, and you should never forget that from your mind.
Beautifully put, the essence and the fiber, because the role that we are playing is actually the fiber, and all of us are the essence. That is what even Shuka tells Parikshit. Shuka tells Parikshit that anything that happens because of divine will, any being or anything that comes forth because of divine will, is an avatar. And therefore he says that each one of us is an avatar. Each being that you see, each bird, each bee, each insect, everything is an avatar. So that is what, going back to the analogy of the drama. So every person is an actor. Every person is an actor, and he's being given a role to perform. A role as a bee, a role as a deer, a role as a tiger, a role as a beggar, a role as a king. And Shuka also says that since these are roles, they are stories of up and down, of despair and hope, and they'll all be there because they are roles in the drama. And therefore he says, we should not focus on the stories of every avatar. Because every avatar means everybody. He says we have to focus on the Yuga avatar. The Yuga avatar is akin to the director of the drama coming in between the scenes, making the corrections or telling what should be done. Basically, whenever the director steps in, the drama or the movie is on a kind of a pause mode. Because everyone is made aware that, these are just the roles, you are actors. In the presence of the director, all are actors, and all realize that all are potential directors and all are actors. The director himself is also an actor. So that is what the Yuga avatar does during the descent. In that time when the descent happens, everyone is reminded of the reality and made to get detached from the roles that they are playing, so that they can enjoy the essence and not get stuck in the fiber. And Shuka also tells the same thing to Parikshit. He tells Parikshit, therefore it is important for us to study and go in depth about the Yuga avatars and not every avatar, because in that sense everything is an avatar and all will be stories of hope and despair. It's only the Yuga avatar which is the story of Prema Dharma and Dharma Prema, which is love for Dharma and about the dharma of prema, of selflessness. So prema dharma and dharma prema, this we will get only in the Yuga avatar, and that is what we will listen to now. That's what Shuka says.
That's a beautiful analogy which you gave of the drama and the drama pausing when the avatar comes. I think that is a format which you often use when we want to portray a complex drama, the idea of a sutradhari coming in between and explaining the plot.
Correct.
Literally it's like that. I think even some of these the recent most Mahabharata, which was televised, we had Krishna coming in between and explaining some of the scenes. I think that's precisely what an avatar does. I mean, we've had the fortune of being in the presence of one, and we've seen that's what happens. I mean, what happens in the presence of Swami is not necessarily unique. I mean, it is the play of mankind and play of creation itself. But when in Swami's presence, you're... your perception gets heightened. Your
awareness, yes.
Your awareness is so heightened that you know that, okay, good has this response, bad has this response. When you do something with a devotional offering, you get this response. That is something which happens all the time. It's not necessarily only when Swami is in a human form. That is a case, when you do good, you always benefit. When you do something wrong, even if nobody is watching, you will get it back. I mean, that is a lesson which is always there. But all of these gets so much amplified when you're in the presence of an avatar. And that is why it is important to read the life of an avatar or the Bhagavatam, as Shuka Maharshi is saying. Because even if you are not in the presence at that moment, when you go through these stories, it is, the highlighting of the story, just like that sutradhari coming and telling that, this is what you have to pay attention to. This is the flow of events that you have to understand and apply in your everyday action. And I think that is why it is important.
You know, honestly speaking, I have not gone through the Bhagavatam as such. The only Bhagavatam that I have gone through is the Bhagavata Vahini in detail, and that is what we are doing. So, many things that Shuka says, I don't know if it is actually what Shuka told Parikshit, but because it is there in the Bhagavata Vahini, I am definitely convinced that Swami has taken on the role of Shuka for all the eager Parikshits out there. All of us are like Parikshits because we are all headed towards the ultimate physical destiny, which is death. And therefore, we are all seeking for ways to find that seeking which we will never have to seek anything else again. So Swami, I feel, has said so many things through this character of Shuka in the Bhagavata Vahini. And it's amazing. Because, you know, when you start the Bhagavatam, you often are convinced that these are stories of Vishnu and his avatars. That is how a layman would define the Bhagavatam.
Right.
But even before beginning the Bhagavatam, Shuka tells Parikshit that Brahma, Vishnu and Maheshwara are not three different gods or anything like that. He says that when there is the Paramatma has different facets and functions. Each aspect and facet or this function has been given a title. So just like we had the mind being divided into Manas, Buddhi, Chitta, Ahankara. Not that there are four different parts of the brain or anything like that. But there are just four different functions of this thing called mind. In the same way, he says God has three functions mainly, which is creation, sustenance and destruction. And that is embodied by Brahma, Vishnu and Maheshwara. These are not three different gods. And it doesn't make sense to compare and contrast them as to who is more powerful, who is less powerful. In this function, God is called as Brahma. In this function, God is called as Vishnu. In the function of destruction, God is called as Maheshwara. So therefore, there are three aspects of the same divinity. And it's not like Bhagavatam is the story of Vishnu or Krishna alone. Bhagavatam is the story of God. That is what Shuka makes it very, very clear.
Right. And that is how the whole story begins. In fact, it begins very unseemingly. I mean, there is no declaration that henceforth now the Bhagavatam starts, or, you know, worship all these gods. That's how we usually do a ritualistic hearing of a scripture or something like that. You start with prayers. But here, it's a very natural narrative which Swami has given, where Shuka explains all of these things, and then he straightaway goes on to the beginning of creation and how, you know, the first man comes and how it directly goes. And so he directly goes into the story of Emperor Manu, who is supposed to be the first son of Lord Brahma. I mean, of course, after explaining that God is in these three forms of Brahma, Vishnu, Maheshwara, he says God in the form of Brahma, the creator, gives forth this first human being in the form of King Manu, he says.
You know, I remember, Prem, I was part of an elocution competition in the university, and the theme that I was given to speak on for 3 minutes was God loves fun. And the first thoughts that came in me was about different instances of humor with Swami, and it's so difficult to compress it into 3 minutes. But then there was an inspiration which I am convinced is divinely inspired. It came in the form of a memory. You know, sitting once on the beach, I was seeing a child who was making his own sand castles, and they were not like very perfect or anything, but for the child it was perfect, because as far as the child is concerned, whatever the child makes is perfect. So he puts a heap and considers that as a dungeon in the fort, and he feels happy. He digs and makes it a cellar, and he's happy, and he's putting a tower. So from the child's point of view, it is a perfect creation. And I was seeing him do that, and as he did that, the high tide was coming, you know. The tide was growing, and so it kept coming closer. So this child then went and, you know, he started building a kind of a wall so that the water, it hits the wall, it's like an embankment and goes away, so his fort is protected. But, you know, after a certain point in time, what can that embankment stop? The waves kept coming, the tide kept growing higher. And this child, you know, I was surprised to see, he just ran and, in a kind of frenzy, you know, he just stomped on the sandcastle that he had built. He thrashed it down and brought it back to nothingness.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a big smile on his face. You know, it was almost like saying, gee, this was real fun. And I was thinking, what sort of a foolishness this is? What? How can this be fun, you know? First of all, you should have built the castle somewhere far away from the sea so that it doesn't get destroyed, so that you need not worry about it. And because as humans, we are always thinking about things for permanence. But later, you know, this thought struck me that possibly this is what the avatar does. The avatar is a divine child, this is what God does. Right. God is a divine child playing in the sands of time. And on the sands of time, as Brahma, he creates. And whatever he creates is perfect for him. We may say, no, this is wrong, that is wrong. As Swami would say in a poem, why is a red beak given to a green parrot? Why is such a, why is such a harsh call given to the beautiful peacock? Who gave this? And we feel like that. In fact, Swami also tells us Chinnakatha of a person who wondered, why is God giving small berries for a big banyan and putting a huge pumpkin on that thin creeper? Of course, he completes the story by saying that when he slept under a banyan tree, he woke up, he saw hundreds of fruits on him. And then he was thankful that God didn't put a pumpkin on the tree, because if had it fallen on him, he would have been severely injured. But as far as God is concerned, everything that he creates is perfect. Whatever Brahma creates is perfect. Because for this child it was perfect. In the sands of time he creates it. And then he sustains it, like how he protected it from the waves. He protects it like Vishnu. And finally, when the time comes, without the slightest attachment, absolutely dispassionately destroys the entire superstructure that he built and admired. And at the end of it, there is no sorrow, there is only joy. There is joy while making, there is joy while protecting, and there is joy even while destruction. So what exists is only ananda, pure bliss. And this was the this was the kind of revelation and inspiration that came within while witnessing this scene. And I feel this is what it comes closely to being God as the Trinity, that is Brahma, Vishnu and Maheshwara.
Absolutely. In fact, it is said that you definitely cannot understand more than this, because, we always find some reason for doing anything. Even when we do something for entertainment, there is a purpose behind it. Something like filling time, you have two things to do, and between that there's time, so you fill it with entertainment. So in that sense, even when you indulge in entertainment, yes, it is for the pure sake of joy, but you have something as small as even occupying a certain amount of time. So when you talk of a being like God, which you're talking of someone who is like, it's not just pure innocence, but it is extremely knowledgeable innocence in that sense, and extreme maturity or a supreme understanding. So you always ask a question like, what is it? Why create and why destroy? What happens in between? So who benefits in the form of creation? Is it just a play? But I think the answer to that is, in our level of existence, we will never be able to understand that. As you said, the closest it comes is that, it is a leela. That is the best explanation you can give for the acts of God. It's a leela, it's a pastime, it's a divine play for the Lord. In fact, I was seeing that beautiful movie which has come, The Man Who Knew Infinity, Ramanujan. There is a wonderful explanation in that he gives about mathematics. In fact, if you read pure mathematics, it's supposed to be closest to a spiritual experience, because it's very, very abstract, and it's all about the symmetry in creation which you otherwise miss. So he gives a description of all his explanations. His wife is asking him, what is all this you keep yourself occupied with? He says, it's like an artist who is making a painting with invisible colors. Okay. So she says, what's the whole point? And he says, for the person who cannot understand it makes no point. But for somebody who begins to understand it, he will see the beauty in the whole thing. So, even within our human existence, there are some things which I can never understand. We can never understand the pure joy of a pure mathematician. And probably a pure mathematician cannot understand the joy which we feel when we're sitting in front of Swami. That's a completely different experience. So you're talking of an experience which is superlative to every human experience, and probably a mix of all of that. So there is no way within our existence we'll be able to understand the purpose behind this creation, sustenance and dissolution. That's why Swami would probably think that there's no point in explaining it to you. Just like how you can't teach pure mathematics to somebody who has just learned 1 plus 1 is equal to 2. I think that is the level we are in right now.
And that is what, later Shuka also tells Parikshit. He says, you just give up all this, give up all your attachment, and listen to this in complete faith and acceptance, and enjoy it. Don't try to explain it, don't try to understand it, because it is beyond. This is what we just now discussed. You can't understand it. So why are you losing out on the essence and juice and the joy simply because you are preoccupied in trying to understand and explain?
Exactly.
Just accept it with this faith, and then enjoy it, and the experience, you will experience the experience that is being described. And it is with this sort of a disclaimer and this sort of a advice that Shuka begins to narrate. And he actually starts off first, as you mentioned, with Emperor Manu and the story of the Matsya Avatar. But I think we will wait for the Matsya Avatar for this, after this little break. Don't go away anywhere, dear listeners. We will be beginning with what is probably the stories of the incarnations of the Bhagavatam after this little break.
And we'll listen to a beautiful rendition of a Devi song. After all, it's Navratri, and the other side of it, we'll continue with the story of Bhagavatam, of course.
Thank you. परम चरम करिक पाणी सुल शैल धनुष बाण परम चरम करिक पाणी सध धन सरगम पधनी रे सधनी प परम चरम करि कृपाणि गम गम प गम नि दप गम सा नि दप म प गम रे सा सा स गम रे सा सा स गम रे सा सा परम चरम करि कृपाणि ग स स सर नि 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 स ध ध ध नि प प ग स सर नि नि स ध ध नि प ग स रे नि स ध नि प रे नि 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 स ध ध ध नि प प प ध म म रे नि नि स ध ध नि प प ध म म रे नि स ध नि प ध म स ध ध ध नि प प प ध म म म प ग ग स ध ध नि प प ध म म प ग ग म रे ग सरे गम पधनि स स रे गम पधनि सरे रे गम पधनि सरे गा गा म पधनि सरे गा मा मा पधनि सरे धनि सरे गा नि सरे गम प म प म प ग म रे सा नि स ध ध नि रे सा ग स रे नि स ध नि प ध म प ग म रे ग स रे ग म प ध नि स ग स रे नि स ध नि प ध म प ग म रे ग स रे ग म प ध नि स ग स रे नि स ध नि प ध म प ग म रे ग स रे ग म प ध नि स परम चरम करि कृपाण सुर शैल धनुष बाण दुर्गे मातरुण तानी भक्त पाल गा मा जय जग जननी देवी जय जग जननी देवी रघुपति पद परमु ते मु ते मु मां दुर्गे मां दुर्गे मां दुर्गे मां दुर्गे मां दुर्गे मां दुर्गे रघुपति पदु परमु तैमु तुलसी छब चलनेनु देवियो प्रसन्न पाल प्रणत पाल गा मा जय जय जग जननी देवी जय जग जननी सुर नर मुनि असुर सेव्य भक्ति मुक्ति दायिनी भयहरण कालिका मा जय जय जग जननी देवी जय जग जननी देवी जय जग
Jai Jai Jag Jai Jai Jag Jai Jai. Welcome back, dear listeners. We were beginning the story of Bhagavatam as sage Sukha was narrating it to Parikshit. He starts with the story of King Manu, and we all know that. I think there is this historical study where they say almost every historical and not historical legends of the scriptural legends of any religion, any community, in any region, always has this concept of the deluge, of a huge flood being a part of history, and the The version which Sanatana Dharma talks about is Manu. And in fact, they say that it refers to the melting of the ice age turning into the other ages, right? Mm. The great melting. So every community which were part of the world, they were in the, they are supposed to have faced a kind of deluge, and they made a legend out of it to mark the time period of Earth when it actually happens.
In fact, it is so beautiful because here we have deluges, or this pralaya as it's called, occurring at the end of every cycle. It is said that the four yugas, Satya, Treta, Dwapara and Kali, are like constituting one day of Brahma. And at the end of the day, as Brahma rests, everything gets destroyed.
Right.
And next day, as he wakes up, the new thing, new day dawns. You know, taking it metaphorically, it is so...
He must be saying, oh, it's been a very long day.
It's been a very absolutely long day, because it is there, given in some thousands or millions of years, each one happening. And it's, if we see it, as I said, metaphorically, that's what happens to us. You know, when we sleep, it's like a short death. Everything comes to a standstill. Everything is of this world. We are dead to this world, and that world is dead to us. And the new creation, the new world begins for us, and we begin for the world as we wake up in the morning. So many times it happens that way, because possibly, you know, forget the dream state as of now, but if we take in the dream state, what happens is it's another different, totally different world. It's not related to this world at all. And when we wake up, it's a new world beginning for us, and that's how it is for Brahma. As he sleeps, entire thing gets destroyed, and that's called a pralaya. So at the end of every Brahma day, there's a pralaya, and the Matsya avatar, or the first avatar as a fish, refers to one pralaya that takes place. One more point to remember is this: Manu is like a common name, you know, like, I don't know, like how we have maybe Oblesus or different names in Andhra, like that each region will have a Kumar, a North Indian name, John maybe. It's a very common, there are multiple, many Johns. In the same way, there are many Manus, and therefore the first ever man, the first creation of Brahma, he is called as Swayambhuva Manu. Swayambhu also means born of nothing else, born on by yourself, because there was no mother and father for the first Manu. So when they say Emperor Manu, I don't know if he is the first Manu or whatever, but Emperor Manu's story is over here. Briefly going through the story of the Matsya Avatar, it all starts when Brahma is about to go to sleep, and it is said that when you are going to sleep, you are not on your alert or not guard on your guard. At that time, a demon by the name Hayagriva steals away all the Vedas. And Swami writes in the Bhagavata Vahini that the Vedas contain the secret of the entire creation. Without the Vedas, creation is not possible. And the other aspect of God, which is Vishnu is supposed to preserve this entire thing, he realizes that if Brahma has lost the Vedas, then when he sleeps, when the whole thing gets destroyed, the pralaya comes and everything gets destroyed, there is no way for the next creation to begin because the Vedas are gone. At the same time, he also sees that in the current yuga, in the current whatever time, span of time, there are some people like Manu who do not deserve to die. And that is the reason to solve these two problems of saving the virtuous as well as retrieving the Vedas from Hayagriva. Hayagriva is presented as a demon with a horse head. Bhagavan Vishnu takes the Matsya Avatar, and the way the Matsya Avatar progresses is also very, very interesting, because it starts off with Manu doing his oblations in the river, right. And in his hand, when he takes water in his cupped hands, cupped palms, he finds a tiny little fish there.
Right, exactly. And that is how he, I think he finds this fish. I don't really know what is the story exactly it goes, because Swami does not refer to it completely. But one version of the story is the fish speaks to Manu and it says that, you know, protect me because there is a bigger fish which my life is endangered because of. So Manu chooses not to pour the water back into the river, like how the ritual is actually performed. So he takes this, you know, palm full of water and he takes it along with him to his kingdom so that this fish can be saved.
Yeah, he takes it to his Kamandalu and
puts it in the Kamandalu. And by the time he reaches his kingdom, his palace, he realizes that the fish has started growing and the Kamandalu is already become a little too constricting for the fish. So then he takes it and he puts it in a bigger tank. That's how the story goes. And
bigger vessel.
And every time he puts it in a bigger vessel, he finds that within minutes or within a very short time, the fish actually starts outgrowing that vessel. And that is when he finally puts it in a huge tank. But even when that is not enough, he comes to the point of releasing it into the ocean.
Yes, the story goes, that he takes it back to the river. And every time the common thing that happens is, however big the fish is becoming, the fish keeps telling king that don't desert me and go away because I need you, please protect me. And because he's a king, it's his duty to protect anybody who takes refuge from him. He's keeping a watch out for the fish. Otherwise once the fish grows to the size of a room, you can just leave it and say, go man, you're fine now.
Take care of yourself.
But because the fish is seeking protection, he's going on looking at the fish. So he shifts it from river to river also, being tugged by boats and different things. And finally, when the fish becomes so big that even a river is not able to suffice for it, he decides that only the ocean is capable of holding the fish. But there also he sees that it's growing so big, soon the ocean might itself not be sufficient. That is when, in all humility, he bows down and says, you are no ordinary fish, you are the Lord. That is when Vishnu says that, yes, though he doesn't say that Brahma is about to sleep, but it's like Vishnu knows that Brahma is about to sleep and therefore the pralaya is coming. So he tells Manu that you please collect all the different beings and everything and have a massive ship made and all of you be on the ship. It's almost like the biblical Noah's Ark.
Right.
Just that this preceded the story of the Noah's Ark by 5,000 or 10,000 years, this story.
Right.
So he tells him to prepare the ship and keep every being ready and I'll be back soon. That's what Vishnu as Matsya says. In the meanwhile, Vishnu goes to the other side of the ocean where this demon Hayagriva is hiding the Vedas. And there is a battle that ensues. Needless to say, Hayagriva is killed and the Vedas are rescued. But the Vedas need something to propagate. And it is said that when the pralaya comes, Brahma is asleep now. The pralaya comes and it's going to destroy everything. Vishnu, the fish is a kind of a fish with a horn, That's how it is depicted. So to the horn of this fish, the king of serpents, Vasuki, is tied as a rope. The other end of Vasuki is tied to the ship in which are all the different species, all the different beings and creatures, pairs, just like the Noah's Ark. So Vishnu is tugging this along, and as he rescues them to safety, it is said that Matsya confers the wisdom of the Vedas, the entire knowledge of the Vedas, to Manu so that Vedas stay alive. And it is said that is how Vishnu protects. So you see, it's not as if Vishnu protects means he stops the pralaya. Because pralaya is Shiva's role, that aspect, that has to go on. But Vishnu ensures continuity because the Vedas are protected, and so because of which the next cycle of creation can also begin. In that sense, Vishnu is the preserving aspect, and that is the story of the Matsyavatar.
And I think this is a very central theme to Sanatan Dharma itself, the idea of a kalpa, which means from the creation beginning to the, dissolution of creation. And within that is the four yugas that we talk about, Satyuga, Trita Yuga, Dwapara and Kali. And it keeps repeating. And this is something which, the moment you understand this, the many things get cleared. Because especially if you listen to Swami's discourses, when Swami is talking about Ramayana, there is the thing where Swami will say, this is what Bharata said. On some other occasion, when Swami is speaking about the same scene, Swami will say, this is what Bharata said, and it will be completely different from what he said. Where the question will be like, what actually happened. But it's very, very clear that, from the point of view which the narrative of Sanatan Dharma, time is given a very, very insignificant role. Which is completely opposite to our understanding in rational thinking, in science, where time and space is given extreme importance.
When you said that, I was just thinking, imagine this drama troupe. I have seen 2-3 troops there, and it's great that this culture is still alive.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there are some auditoriums that have been built in Bangalore especially for dramas to be portrayed, and they're built acoustically so well. Of course, they're built elsewhere in the world also. I'm speaking of Bangalore because I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're built so beautifully acoustically that anything you speak can be heard by the audience. There's no need of any mic and hanging mics or collar mics or anything like that.
Okay.
So there are these performances, you know. So just like you have a movie show, there are drama shows, which means this troupe is performing the same drama over and over again,
mm-hmm.
twice a day or thrice a day. And you know, these are all very adept actors, and therefore they perform one particular drama for a week or 2 weeks, after which they take on and practice and start another drama.
Okay.
So now when we are speaking of different kalpas, in different kalpas the same yugas repeat, in the same yugas the same avatars, everything repeat. That's how it is said. And so there's Ramayana happening in every Treta Yuga of every kalpa. So now imagine when the actors are speaking, as I said, it's all live, it's happening. There's a probability that an actor, instead of saying, "Hey, you, stop," he may say, "Hey, stop, you there." Okay. So if I say that he said, "Hey, stop, you there," and somebody else says, "He said, hey, you, stop there." I mean, both are true. How can both be true? How can it be true? And if you wonder like that, that wondering comes only if you are unaware that this drama is being repeated over and over and over again. I'm saying this because this is the analogy I tell myself when you think about how can Swami say that Rama said this, and again in another discourse say Rama said this, another discourse it say Rama said this. And sometimes I used to think in an early stage that, okay Swami, you know, you take leeway, you change the story however you want, because the idea is to drive home a lesson. But today I realize that it's not just about driving home a lesson. It can definitely be true also, because these are multiple portrayals of the same drama, and there's a chance that though the script has remained same, a dialogues have changed here and there a little bit. I mean, because the actors are given their flexibility that you convey the spirit, it doesn't matter what words you use. So therefore, you know, this is the thing that strikes, and even as this thing strikes in you, you read what Swami is saying in the Bhagavata Vahini. He's, of course, he says it through Shuka. He says that all these stories and history that you hear about the early times, you may get your doubts. But know that the leelas of the divine are beyond your comprehension. So don't try to understand them. That is what we emphasized even at the beginning of the Vahini, even at the beginning of this satsang. So that is what Shuka tells. So they are beyond comprehension. The divine will need not be explicable. But for you to benefit, just have faith and enjoy. I think that is a recurrent theme that we should keep in our mind, that let me not try to question and be critical, because then I will miss the point and I will lose the joy. Let me just have faith and enjoy.
And you know, the beautiful symbolism of this particular episode is where Manu is allowed to, you know, live past that deluge, where he is the continuity of, you know, one kalpa to the other. And what you made a beautiful reference to, it's because he does not deserve to die. He actually has the right to live on. In fact, the entire Bhagavata Vahini starts with that episode of Narada narrating one incident. I think we had Brother Giridhar or Amay who had shared that story of a beautiful story of Narada explains how he became Sage Narada. And we all know that Sage Narada is actually a Manasaputra of Brahma. Mm. He does not have a life otherwise. But he speaks of a time when he was a Brahmin and he did some things, and then he turned to the name of the Lord. And when, I don't know who he narrates that story to, he narrates it to, I think, Sage Vyasa, if I'm not...
There's that girl who is supposed to be right, Mother Earth on the shore.
Right, Bhakti.
Bhakti, weeping. Yes.
Devotion takes the form of a woman, and to her he actually narrates that story. And she's asking that, but you're born out of, you know, Brahma's will, and how do you have this story? And he says, no, not this kalpa. It's the previous kalpa. If you look at it, it is actually that act which he did out of devotion that has actually outlived the deluge which has come, which has led him to be born as Sage Narada. In fact, there's another reference which is often quoted, even Swami would make a reference to that, of someone like Hanuman is going to become the next Brahma. You know, that is something which I think Kamavadani Garu used to often say, that according to the scriptures, that Hanuman has lived such a stellar life that as a reward for the next kalpa, he is going to be born as the Brahma of this, you know, the earthly plane.
Without trying to lower its significance, you know, in the worldly terms, it's almost like when you do your role well in a drama, you get better and better roles, you become the hero. And finally, if we see the trend of movies going ahead, all the ones who have done excellent acting, they become directors themselves. Right. It's like that, you know, Hanuman, exactly. You did a perfect role as an actor, you become the director, you become Brahma.
Absolutely. And, you know, and the idea is, the good that you do actually lives, and that is what actually is carried over even past that point of deluge, in the case of Manu. And, you know, going back to that idea of time being so insignificant. In fact, there was a beautiful analogy, an incident which one of our teachers were narrating, that they were in the interview room with Swami and they asked this question about some character. I think it was King Vikramaditya. They were asking Swami that, Swami, there are so many stories about King Vikramaditya. You know, who was the real Vikramaditya and which period of time did he live in? So Swami was saying that, no, it is not like that. See, that's a title which is given to a person who achieves something. It's not necessarily one personality. And then Swami was emphasizing this idea that time is not very significant when you're talking about purpose. When you're talking about life's journey, time is actually a very insignificant measure of life's journey. And I mean, that explains why we actually are getting so confused with life itself, that we give so much importance to young age and adulthood and, you know, teenage and all of that. And it seems Swami was explaining this and giving a lot of other examples and all that. And suddenly Swami asked, what's the time? So they said, Swami, this is the time. And then Swami said, 45 minutes since you asked this question. And then everybody realized that, you know, Swami was telling such interesting things that they lost track of time. And then Swami said, see, did you notice? You spent 45 minutes in the interview room, but it felt like you spent only 10 minutes. So Swami said, when your mind is occupied with something so much more subtler and superior, time actually loses reference to you. Something which Einstein said, you know, the theory of relativity is all about that. He gives the example of sitting on a stove versus sitting next to a pretty woman. He says how the concept of time changes. Mm-hmm. And Swami is saying that's what it is, and that's why time should not be given much importance. And I think probably that is an idea which we should have in our mind when we are going through these stories, that it need not necessarily mean in the form of time and space play that we understand some of these stories.
From the same Matsya story, before we move on to the other next story that Shuka again narrates, which Swami narrated very much in brief. One more inspiration, you know, from the Matsya Avatar story is, many times when we feel that we don't have God in our life, or we are late, we are unlucky, you know, we compare ourselves with, forget the sages and saints and the great devotees, with normal other people in our lives, and we feel we don't have the kind of devotion they have. I feel for such kind of thoughts where we feel that we are insignificant and small, this Matsya Avatar story is so beautiful, because it just requires us to allow God into our life in some small manner. As small as that little fish which was like a tadpole in his palm. Just let God in and then see the magic, the divine magic, because God will grow. He'll grow to such a level, He'll fill everything. That is what I felt happens. The king in his kingdom is not able to find a vessel or even a water body large enough to hold the Lord. That big the Lord becomes. And the Lord, who was nothing but a minuscule part in one part of his palm, now becomes his entire universe. I feel that's what happens to each one of us also. We have to just take that first step. That's why Swami says, take one step towards me, I'll take 100 towards you. We have to just take that first step and in some small manner let God, possibly it's attending a bhajan, possibly it's attending a satsang, possibly it's doing one act for him in a day, something like that. In some small manner, let us allow God into our life, and like that Matsya Avatar, he will grow to become our entire life itself, our entire universe itself. And therefore I feel it is a very, very motivating example, metaphor and a story.
Right. And then of course we know that the Matsya Avatar is the first among the 10 avatar, the Dasha Avatar, which is spoken about. And the second in that is Kurma Avatar. Of course, Swami does not make a elaborate reference into that. In this context, what Swami has spoken about it before, where, you know, Lord Vishnu takes the form of a tortoise, and refer to as Kurma Avatar, and the purpose of that is to aid in the churning of the ocean, where he becomes the base on which the Mount Meru is placed as the churning rod.
And again, Vasuki is
used, right,
as the ropes, and one side the devas and the other side the asuras. I mean, it's symbolic of the world, that there are forces of good and evil that are churning, and in that churning it begins, you know, there is first alahala, that comes the poison, and then different things come. It is said Lakshmi, the horse.
Right.
Yeah, different things. Ultimately it's Amrita that comes, which again Vishnu comes in the form of Mohini and ensure that only the ones who are deserving, who are good, the devas get the Amrita, and the asuras, the rakshasas, the one with the arshad vargas, the six negative qualities, are denied that. So, you know, in that context, I just remember once, I don't know to whom it was, but Swami had made the mention saying that Prashanti Nilayam, you know, you have heard the story of the churning of the ocean. When people come to Prashanti Nilayam, that churning begins in each and every individual. So, therefore, you know, you will, when we get this question as to how come that person is so cruel to me, he's so nasty, he's so aggressive, this is not the kind of person you will expect in a place like Prashanti, which means the supreme peace. So Swami said, the moment you step into Prashanti, know that the churning has begun. Not only for you, for everybody else who has done. And when the churning begins, the first thing that comes is the deadly poison. All the poison that is within has to come out. It's only ultimately that the Amrita comes. But know for sure that having arrived to Prashanti, your journey towards Amritam has begun. And I feel that is another beautiful thing to keep in mind, because we have our concept saying that the world is a dirty place. Prashanti Nilayam is a pure, pristine place. It is pure and pristine in the sense that it starts us on our journey towards Amrita. But to think that I will not encounter somebody who will speak rudely to me, somebody who will push me, or somebody who is not understanding, I think that is a wrong understanding, a misunderstanding.
And the other extension of that is the churning process. You might start it for anything in between, because many of us do that. When we come to Swami, we ask something much lesser, but once the churning starts, it's going to stop only when Amritam comes out. And that is something which we must not forget, because that is something which always disturbs us. You know, it seems like there is never an end to suffering at all. Sometimes it happens that it all comes in cycles. Everything is going fine, then suddenly everything breaks down, then you manage everything, then again it breaks down. The truth of that is that till the point where the Amritam comes out, the churning can never stop, even if you wish for it.
Because as Swami would put it, everything else is anritam. Anritam meaning untruth.
Untruth, right.
Actually not untruth, because Swami says truth itself has got nijam, satyam and rutam. Nijam is fact day to day. Satyam is the next level. The ultimate level, which is beyond all time, is called rutam. So anritam is that which is not rutam, that's all. So Amritam, you have to give up the Anritam. And then after the Kurma avatar is the Varaha avatar. Before going into the Varaha avatar, because you know we will be going into each of these avatars possibly in brief, I was reminded of an interesting revelation that Swami did during one of the Ramzan festivals. I think it was the year 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And some of us had gathered in bhajan hall because we were going to put up a program for Ramzan. That day Swami came and began to talk to all the students in the bhajan hall, all of the participants of that program. And mm-hmm. It turned out to be a memorable 1 hour session with Swami. After which, of course, we didn't put up any program, because Swami said, why do you want to put up the program? In the sense that the prime reason why we want to put up any program is to win some interaction with Swami, so that we can speak a little with him, he speaks with us. We got this 1 hour of him speaking with all of us, so there was no need for the program in that sense. But during that 1 hour interaction, Swami mentioned so many things. One of those things was this. He said that, you know, the Dashavatar, if you see actually, is symbolic also of the way evolution happened.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a, debate going on whether life is an intelligently designed evolution,
mm-hmm.
or is it an evolution of intelligent design?
Okay.
You know, is it an evolution of the intelligent design? That is what science says. Or the creationists say that it's an intelligently designed evolution. Yeah, it is an evolution, but who designed that evolution? That's what they say.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter how you look at it, whether you look at it as an intelligently designed evolution or an evolution of intelligent design. It's the same thing, and that's what Swami said. He said, you see, life also begins in the ocean as a fish. That's Matsya. Then the amphibian, that is Kurma. Then the mammal, that is Varaha. Then he says, comes to this kind of a deformed man, you know, a dwarf man, not a man actually. That is Vamana. That we go. Before Vamana, we come across Narsimha. Beings which are half man-like and half animal-like. That is what is Narsimha. After which you come to man, but a kind of a dwarf man, not the man as we know. So that is Vamana. Then comes Parashurama, which is man. And then Swami says it goes on to Rama, which is perfect man. So that is how evolution is. And Swami said that the evolution doesn't... We have mistaken that evolution stops with being a perfect man. But that is why, you know, again, I'm reminded of another thing where Swami once built up a suspense. He said that I'm going to reveal a great secret in the talk in the auditorium. And everybody was looking forward to the talk, and Swami built up so much of anticipation for that. Swami said, I'll be revealing a great secret. And when everybody gathered, the great secret that Swami revealed turned out to be like a anticlimax, because Swami started speaking normally. And somewhere in the middle of the discourse, Swami said, I have been promising you that I'll reveal the great secret. The great secret is this. And as everybody's ears perked up and everybody straightened their backs, Swami said, you are not animal. And everybody was like, oh, what's the big deal in this secret? And Swami said, not only that. So once again, the ears perked up. He said, you're not animal, you're human. And again, once again, it was disappointment. Swami said, not only that, you're not human, you're divine. Even then, you know, people thought, what is the big deal about it? Not realizing that this is the ultimate secret. And unless Swami gives a build-up and a suspense like that, we don't pay attention to it, because it has become so commonplace to hear it and say it. But this is the secret. The secret is, you don't stop with being just a human. You have to evolve to become Krishna, the perfect avatar. And Swami said, that is the significance of the Dashavatar. But instead of man progressing towards Krishna, man seems to progress towards animals. He behaves like a dog, he behaves like a pig. You're devolving. And that was the message that Swami delivered to us in the bhajan hall that day on Ramzan. And I feel that's another beautiful interpretation of the Dashavatar.
Right, absolutely. I mean, there is certainly some pattern in that. You know, it's not just legend. It's not just mere making of a story. Because there is so much understanding in that, and that's what I think many other occasions also Swami has spoken about, the similarity between evolution and the Dashavatar. In the story that Shuka is narrating, of course, he next speaks about the Varaha Avatar. As we said, he doesn't speak much about the Kurma Avatar, in fact doesn't mention it all. He goes to Varaha Avatar, where again even when I used to hear this as a little kid, I used to wonder, the picturization of this is, you have this asura who's Hiranyaksha. He's Hiranyakashipu's elder brother, actually, Hiranyaksha, who actually steals the entire earth, and he hides it under the oceans. And even as a seven or eight year old child seeing this, I used to wonder, you know, how do you take the earth and hide it in the ocean? The ocean is part of the earth.
It's like telling, I hid your house in your room.
Right, exactly. And I used to wonder, you know, where else is this ocean that you can take an entire earth and hide it inside an ocean? You know, in the space, is there another ocean? But I think what it really means is, it's more, maybe or maybe not, as we started off by saying that we are only trying to find ways of explaining something which is actually inexplicable.
Which should actually be just accepted.
Right. But one of the ways of looking at it is, this is something which they say, that when you talk of the different lokas, they speak of 14 lokas, that is one thing which is spoken of in the scripture. The Patala and Sutala and Brahmaloka and Shivaloka.
Yeah, there are supposed to be 7 below.
Right.
And 7 above. And in fact, Yama is supposed to be the ruler of the 7 below. So
exactly.
There are Atala, Vitala, Sutala, Rasatala, Patala, Talatala. I think there are the 7.
Right. So all of that is... And they describe this as actually different levels of vibration. And the earth is supposed to be very special. That is why being born a human being is very special. Because here is the plane where you can choose to do something and do it, and it's a very perfect opportunity for either removing bad karma or performing good karma. And much of it cannot be done in other lokas. That's what again, I don't know the exact explanation or understanding of that. So in that sense, when you say that you've taken the earth and you've hidden it under the water or under the ocean, it could actually mean that taking this physical plane to a vibration where it is different from the vibration that it really exists. You're taking it underground or taking it to a more subtler vibration where it becomes impossible to subsist in or live in or perform the actions which is meant to be performed in the earthly plane.
Exactly, and multiple other times where it is said that the earth's vibrations are perfect, it is only as in a human birth. That's why Jantuna Narajanma Durlabham, it is not said Deva Janma Durlabham. It is not said being born as a Deva or a demigod is blessed. To be born as a human, because it's only human who has the capacity to realize the oneness with the ultimate. And it is said, therefore, even the Devas would like to descend to the earth. The earth is somewhat like a, you know, I don't know, because there is 7 below and 7 above, I am often reminded in chemistry, we have this pH where up to 7 it's all acidic. And 1 is severely acidic, and from 7 to 14 is basic, it's severely basic. So here also all the basal tendencies are below, and all the devas are supposed to be above. But all said and done, when you and me, what is bliss and what is divine, what is most important is to be exactly in the middle. I don't want acidic nor basic. It's almost like that. It's almost like that it is not as if the highest heaven is the best place to be in. The best place to be in is on the earth, because it is from earth you can go to anything and also attain the ultimate. And so the story goes that Hiranyaksha has hidden the earth. But before that, you know, another interesting thing, we have mentioned it before in our discussion on means and ends.
Mm-hmm.
But the story of Hiranyaksha itself is interesting, because Hiranyaksha and his brother Hiranyakashipu, who is also killed by one of the other avatars of Vishnu, which is the Narasimha avatar, which is the next avatar after Varaha.
Right.
So, Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha are actually Jaya and Vijaya, who are guarding the gates of Vaikuntha. And it is said that the Sanat Kumaras, the four sons of Brahma, are visiting, and these two stop the Sanat Kumaras from entering the Vaikuntha because they think these are kids. And they tell them that, you know, Vishnu is resting now, so go away. So they are angered, not the kind of anger you and me feel, but they are having a righteous anger, saying that the Lord is always available to his devotee. So when you are saying this, you are committing a terrible sin, because you cannot say that the Lord is sleeping and not available. And every time we come here and every time the Lord is available, how can you say this? We don't believe that the Lord is not available. We believe that you are acting as a barrier between a devotee and the Lord. Don't try to be a barrier or an intermediary between devotee and the Lord. I mean, that lesson is very, very strong, because they curse. They curse that you are doing this because you are thinking that you are God yourself. That is why you are trying to do all this. Therefore, you will be born as normal mortals on earth. This is the curse. You will no longer be in service of God, because being in service of God, you have come to assume Godship on yourself. This is the curse that is pronounced. It is said that hearing the noise going on, Vishnu comes out and he finds out this is what has happened. He tells the Sanat Kumaras to forgive. They say that we can forgive them, but we can't take back the curse, because all said and done, they have done the crime of coming between the Lord and the devotee. So therefore, anybody who tries to come between a Lord and the devotee, be warned. You know, you are building up a terrible thing for yourself, whoever is wanting to do this. So when the Sanat Kumaras leave, Jaya and Vijaya fall at the feet of Vishnu and they profusely cry. They say that, Lord, we don't mind any of the curse, but it is the thought of being away from you that is paining us. And Vishnu is moved by their love and he says, since you have repented, you will be given a choice. You know, you need not spend all. You spend 7 births, that's all. 7 births away from me as my devotees. They say, but Lord, 7 births is so difficult. 7 birth lifetimes is also tough to be away from you. He says, then spend only 3 lifetimes, but as my enemies. And they say, Lord, how can we ever think of hating you? But then they realize that when you hate someone, you think of that person more than when you love someone, you know. They say that, you know, when we hate somebody, actually, this is a real truth. It's a sad truth also. We think of the person whom we don't like, whom we dislike, whom we hate, more than the person whom we love. So they say that, you know what, it will be better because we will be spending only 3 lifetimes, and also we will be thinking of Vishnu more than a devotee possibly. So this story we often narrate to support the thing that means justify the ends. And therefore it is said Jaya Vijaya are given 3 lifetimes on earth as haters of Vishnu. And one is as Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu combination, both of whom are killed by Vishnu. The other combination is Ravana and Kumbhakarna in the Treta Yuga, killed by Rama. And finally, Shishupala and Dantavakra, who are again killed by Krishna. So that is the story, I feel, which is so beautiful, because you will realize that everything, the good, the bad, the ugly, whatever we see in the world, is part of His divine plan. And when we know that, just like we enjoy these stories, we will enjoy everything in life as well.
Right. Of course, it's much easier said than done. And we can say that from our point of view itself. Because when we get involved, pain really hurts and happiness is really attractive, right? That's the whole problem. But, you know, I think that is what is enhanced and portrayed in the setup itself of Parikshit, who has literally become a renunciant. You know, he's a king who has given up everything. He knows that this is the inevitable. Death is the inevitable. There is no point in holding on to what is pleasurable and running away from what is painful and what is wealth and what is a form of penury. He gives up everything because he says death is anyway going to come. Life has to be sanctified. And that renunciation has led him to come and sit on the banks of the river, and he's listening to the story. So the attitude with which he will listen to all of this is in a state of complete acceptance, which is what is the attitude required for Shravanam itself. And that is what Swami, I mean, as you beautifully said, that to look at the story only as a story, you know, I don't get so involved in, I mean, that's the best way to listen to the Lord's story. I mean, even if you see a movie, even if you see a serial, it's so difficult to not get angry when something bad happens, or not to feel happy when something good is happening. And what do we tell about our own life? You know, it's so difficult to lead a detached life. But the attitude with which it has to be gone through has been explained in the setup of Parikshit sitting there, having given up the kingdom, saying that I'm waiting for my death, but I'll sanctify the time till the point that happens.
As you said, you know, when we get so involved, our involvement is so intense in a movie. I remember myself, whenever there's a movie and there's a point where good triumphs over evil, that's such a kind of satisfaction. I actually rewind and watch that 2-3 times. In fact, there are some movies which I have seen multiple times, but all the not so good parts, you know, I forward them. I don't want to see that. I don't want to see the good suffering. But when it comes to that point which gives you great satisfaction, you know, you want to see it 2-3 times. I'm saying this because that is the kind of attitude even Parikshit is having. Because Shuka starts off with Swayambhuva Manu, the first man created, and he says that, in fact, you know, Swami, before saying this, Swami writes about how for any creation to happen, attraction is a very important ingredient. For any creation, and therefore Brahma had to divide himself into two, and one became Swayambhuva Manu, other became Satrupa. Satrupa was so beautiful, it said that she had the beauty of 100 different forms. That's why it is said Satrupa, or 100 or 1000, I don't know. She was also known by another name, which is Brahma Priya. So this was the first man and woman who were just born of the will of God. And after that, he goes on to say that how Brahma told them that you are attracted to each other, now go ahead and populate the earth. And even as Shuka is going ahead with this, Parikshit is saying, you know, I don't want all these stories, you know, please forward off all these parts. I'm not interested in the stories of Moha. I want to know only of that part of the story which is going to grant me salvation. And when he tells this, Shuka actually smiles because he's seeing the eagerness in Parikshit, and he's also sensing that emergency sense that Parikshit is having, because he's thinking that I've got only 7 days. Don't go like right from the beginning and how they populated. I don't want to know all that. I just want to know the redeeming stories which will help me in my life. So as I said, what we do in the movie is Parikshit is also doing here. And Shuka smiles and he says to Parikshit that this is a very, very noble trait that you're having. Possibly Shuka also identifies with him, because, you know, Shuka didn't want to go through all this, right? Even in his own life, we spoke about it last satsang. He didn't want to go through the brahmacharya, the grihastha, vanaprastha directly. He was born it as a sannyasi. So I think possibly Shuka is empathizing with Parikshit, where he says, you forward all these unnecessary parts and come to the crux.
Right. And I think that's what we have done here, because we started off by speaking about Varaha, but we didn't complete that story where we said actually Hiranyaksha takes the earth to, you know, a lower plane, where that's when Lord Vishnu comes as Varaha, defeats Hiranyaksha, kills him. And then that is why that the portrayal of Varaha is of that being with the face of a boar and the earth on the nose of that bull.
On the tusks.
On the tusks and the snout.
Going by some stories which I read, apparently he makes an entire list of all the beings who should not be able to kill him, and somehow Hiranyaksha misses putting the wild boar in that list.
Okay.
So that's why Vishnu takes the form of a wild boar. That's how it is.
And that's how he...
And on his tusks...
And he literally raises the earth from there. And once this is done, that is when, you know, Manu and Satrupa come in. Once the earth has been restored, the Vedas have been put in place
by Hiranyaksha is killed.
And now the earth is ready to be populated by the human race. And that is when the story of Manu and Satrupa start, where Manu becomes the first man. In fact, Brahma creates one being which is separated into Manu and Satrupa, and who will be the first parents of the world.
So, after this, when we look at the Bhagavata Vahini, Swami goes ahead. In fact, there is not much detailed description about the Narasimha avatar or the other avatars, but there is a very beautiful dialogue that takes place between Shuka and Parikshit, where, you know, Parikshit knows about Shuka's birth, how he refused to come out of the womb because he said that there's nothing in this world. And even after he came out, we saw that last week, how Krishna comes and assures him that he won't be touched by Maya. After he comes out, he directly skips everything and goes to the sannyasa stage. So it is here that Parikshit asks Sage Shuka, you are one beyond attachment, you know, detachment, you are an epitome of detachment. How is it that you got attracted to these stories? You know, you have come to tell me the stories. I'm sure that you have come all the way just to tell me the stories. How is it that you got attracted to stories? Because you should not get attracted to anything else, right? You are an epitome of detachment. That's a beautiful conversation. I think we'll reserve it for our next Bhagavata Vahini Satsang, because the time in our studio shows 1:58, dear listeners, and it's time for us to bring down the curtains on this episode. We are grateful to Swami as always for this beautiful opportunity to live through the Bhagavatam, the stories of Bhagavan, the stories that take the Bhakta closer to Bhagavan. And in whatever form Bhagavan has done it, it is so sweet and wonderful. And on behalf of everybody, we are grateful to Swami. We offer this at His lotus feet. And we will end with a song, on the other side of which will be the next segment, Love to Love. The next fortnight, dear listeners, we will be taking on some general topics, as is the practice. And the fortnight after that, we will continue with the Bhagavata Vahini. Vijayadashmi is coming in a day or two. Hope you have had a holy and wonderful Navratri so far. Wishing you a wonderful Vijayadashmi. May this be the day when we get victory over the lower vibrations within us. May we crown and seat Swami in our heart. With that prayer, we bring this to a close.